Hello and welcome to The Libertarian, a production of Defining Ideas for the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Law at the NYU School of Law, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, abuses at the IRS. All right, Richard, it came to light last week, since our last podcast, that the IRS had been targeting groups that had the word patriot or the phrase Tea Party in their organization's names for special scrutiny and justifying their tax-exempt status. Some subsequent reporting from an inspector general's report makes it look as though the net may have actually been cast even wider than that. And there's some reporting that's come out since then that indicates that this may have been going on even longer than was previously described, that it may have included things like organizations that were trying to teach people about the Constitution, a pretty broad net, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the structural question here, and it's not an easy one, but when you have a provision of the law, like the tax-exempt status mm-hmm. that applies to these groups, these 501c4 groups, they're classified as social welfare organizations, mm-hmm. and they can participate in politics, but it can't be their primary focus. So already, even by that definition, you can see that that's a classification that's going to require a certain amount of scrutiny and discretion from the IRS to make sure that they really meet those standards. So how, when the agency is in a position where you have to delegate them a certain amount of authority to make those judgment calls, can you most effectively preclude them from abusing that power, as it seems that they did here?
Well, this is a very hard question, because the requirement for these various civic organizations is that they be not for profit. That's not particularly difficult to reach. These guys are not trying to make money. But they're supposed to be designed exclusively for the promotion of social welfare. And that's a phrase which is entirely ticklish, because the following question always arises. If somebody is in there on a political issue trying to get a particular program or a candidate through, can you say that it's for the promotion of social welfare when you know at the get-go that they're going to be 45 or 55% of the people in this country who are opposed to everything that you stand for? So that, for example, suppose you have to move away from the Tea Party for a second. You have two groups that are designed to deal exclusively for the social welfare, one of which is in favor of abortion rights and the other which is opposed to them. Can they both get tax-exempt status? Can neither of them get tax-exempt status? Or, God forbid, could one and not the other getting there? And so what happens is, if you look at this kind of criterion, it's very watery. The only thing that it excludes are full-time political PACs of one sort or another. But it turns out that you have to have a strong theory of social welfare, which is independent of the views that various people are going to support. And that becomes something of a kind of a linguistic and philosophical absurdity or difficulty. So what happens? You can't decide to simply, as the IRS, not to grant anybody allowances under this provision. So you have to figure out who gets it and who doesn't. And all that one can say about this is that the discretion is certainly irreducible, but it has to be exercised in a uniform fashion with respect to both sides. So that if you're going to be very critical of the way in which Tea Party groups try to lobby for small government, you have to be equally critical about the way in which various civil liberties organizations lobby for an extensive extension, for example, of the employment discrimination laws or the increased subsidies for abortion rights and all the rest of that stuff. And what happens is, when you get an administration like the Obama administration, it kind of suffuses a bit of self-righteousness going down through the ranks. And so, you know, you spend all your time denouncing certain kinds of people for being essentially against the common welfare, you know, those who favor the top 1%, for example. It's easy for an organization to kind of take the wink and the nod, figure out what their own democratic proclivities are, and then slowly start to tilt the scale. And it takes a lot of willpower in order to prevent that from happening. And in this particular case, I think it's not only that they skewed it, but they also, it seemingly, lied to Congress with respect to whether or not this was being done. Remember, none of this is hidden. If you are going to give an organization a hard time by demanding, for example, that it supply biographical data of all the key members and contributors to it, anything that you do is going to be open in the public the moment that you do it. And it's not too difficult for these organizations to read voice languages and all sorts of other stuff to say, you know, they really don't like us, and they're going after us, and then they report it back. So what's going to make this extremely ticklish for the president is that the anecdotes will be coming through a mile a minute on this stuff. The Congress had this thing, and then Miller, you know, the current guy who's in charge of the IRS, sort of denied that this was going on. And if you look at the timeline, it seems as though this thing happened for about, oh, I don't know, close to 2 years from the time that the policy started to take place to the current time. Initiation seems to be, according to a timeline prepared by the Wall Street Journal, starting in about April and March of 2010, and we're already into May of 2013. That's 3 years. And so this is going to be, I think, extremely ticklish for the president to deal with, which is why it is he took the right political stance, which is to denounce this as outrageous, because it is.
On that point about it looking like the IRS is misled Congress over this, one of the points that the Obama administration has made in response to this story is that the IRS is an independent enforcement agency. They only have two political appointees, and that the director at the time a lot of this was happening was a Bush appointee, which raises an interesting question. Most people probably default to thinking that an approach like that makes sense. You staff an agency with civil servants who are supposedly just dispassionately trying to do their jobs. But when you see this, do you maybe want more political appointees precisely because in this kind of situation, it gives you a leash to pull on and it makes it somewhat easier to call people to account?
Yeah, it's a very hard choice. Two political appointees in an agency that has thousands of people may not be enough for an administration to put its input on there. But when one realizes what the complexity of the IRS is, and indeed all the multiple exemptions that are available under Section 501C, there are six or seven classes, whatever it is, there are thousands of groups that are applying for these kinds of exemptions. There is no way that political appointees can do anything other than set policy. And, you know, what you'd have to do is to figure out whether or not the people who are directly in charge of this down lower could themselves be political appointees. You know, you see that A reports to B reports to C, and you know if you've got three layers there, by the time you get to the third layer, you've got 40 or 50 different kinds of people. Remember, too, that to try to get these people through, some of them are going to have to be confirmed by the Senate, and there's a huge backlog, part of which is because of the political divisiveness of major appointments at the top, and part of which is that the sheer slog that it takes to get some of these people up and running is just an enormous type of situation. So I think in the end, you may be able to get yourself from a situation of having, you know, two or three political appointees up to having eight or ten. But if you want to use political appointees to solve this problem, you're going to have to run it up to 150 or 200 people. And that's just not possible. Political appointees stay for 2 years and so forth. You would have to have a confirmation mill in the Senate, which would mean that it could do nothing else, which might not be a bad thing, all things considered, but which under the current circumstances, utterly, thoroughly, and completely unrealistic.
In the wake of this scandal, a lot of people, particularly on the left, are pointing the finger back at the Supreme Court's decision a few years ago in the Citizens United case. And they say, look, you've created an atmosphere in which many of these supposed social welfare organizations are really just, I mean, as you mentioned, thinly veiled partisan political operations. And so they say IRS may have been mistaken in singling out these conservative Tea Party groups. But you know what? We should have more scrutiny of who gets that nonprofit status, and we probably opened that window too wide. How do you react to that?
Well, I think they're right on the last point that it's probably open too wide. But if that's correct, then all the other political organizations on the other side of the political spectrum will find themselves stripped of their tax-exempt status as well. So that the basic rule here is when you don't have clear norms which delineate those organizations that are exclusively for the social welfare from those that are political, is that you tamp down equally on both sides. That is, you have to have a very strong non-discrimination rule, and their question completely avoids that. As to the Citizens United situation, I regard that as a complete red herring in these cases. The issue in that case is whether or not corporations have the status of persons that are protected under the First Amendment, which doesn't refer to any person. It says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the press. The New York Times is a corporation, and I dare say that it's entitled to voice its view on this and any other issue. So too the Wall Street Journal. Most standard line corporations, in effect, go exactly in the opposite direction. They have no desire whatsoever to embed themselves through their corporate name in politics, because what they quickly discover is that the people who agree with them sign, the people who disagree with them mount mass boycotts. No corporation that I was aware of signed any of the briefs supporting the First Amendment claims. It was supported by activist organizations like the Cato Institute, the ACLU, I think, may have been involved in that. It was certainly supported by the Chamber of Commerce and by the AFL-CIO, but you couldn't see Coors Beer or anybody else signing up on this thing. And remember what the case was about. It was about Hillary the movie. And Citizens United was not a profit-making corporation. It was essentially a political group, which is perfectly evident from its name, Citizens United against all these bad Democratic candidates. So, I mean, that is clearly protected political speech. And, of course, they weren't seeking any kind of tax exemptions, which is the thing here. So one of the things that's so terrible about the president on this issue and many of the Democrats is they really villainize the Citizens United decision and make it appear as though it's a modern rendition of Dred Scott or something equally extreme. And that's just simply beyond the point. The question here is one of probity and fairness with respect to administration, given the statute is on its books with its rather nebulous criterion. It failed at that level. The president was right to essentially say that the behavior that took place was outrageous. And I think it's a mistake for anybody to divert themselves from that issue by trying at this particular junction and conjunction with this particular issue to say that we have to revisit the entire climate of campaign contributions on the one hand, or the administration of the charitable exemption provisions as a matter of high policy on the other. I think the president and everybody else has to live with this thing, and I think he's done the right thing to denounce it. The question is, what follows the denunciation? And for that, we just have to wait.
Richard, this story with the IRS came out last Friday, which was May the 10th, still percolating in the press yesterday. And on top of it, we now have another story that indicates that the Justice Department got access to 2 months' worth of phone records. No actual phone calls. They didn't have the audio, but phone records from a wide array of reporters and editors with the Associated Press, apparently tied in, it looks like, with an investigation by the U.S. Attorney in Washington as to a possible national security leak that came out of an AP story last year regarding a CIA unit in Yemen. Now, we should be cautious on this because it just came out yesterday and we don't have all the information, but there's an obvious tie-in here, connection with, again, it looking like the Obama administration has overstepped at least prudential limits, if not legal limits, on the kind of scrutiny or surveillance that they should be applying. I mean, how do you think this plays out, particularly in connection with the IRS story?
Well, I think the synergies are clearly very negative for the administration, and on that I claim no originality whatsoever. But I think the nature of the struggles, I think, are somewhat different. With respect to the IRS struggle, the optimal strategy for the president is to disown himself from what is done by people internal to the office and to announce that he's going to see that it's going to be set right. And every key Democrat has followed him, so there's no partisan disagreement. But there's no way that he could disown himself from the decisions of his own attorney general, who seems to have been directly involved in ordering the examinations of what takes place at the Associated Press. And in fact, you know, its chief executive officer, a fellow named Gary Pruitt, seems to have come out swinging about the wildly inappropriate nature of the activities that were undertaken. And I have to say, you know, based upon the first appearance, it looks as though the man seems to have a point. I mean, it's quite clear that there are leaks that take place one way or another, but for you to try and do this at that level is, of course, very, very, I think, dangerous because of the chilling effect on all other kinds of speech. We don't know all the details yet. I'm not even sure whether or not the attorney general or his subordinates actually sought to get a warrant, and if so, how far that warrant was going to go. And if they did get a warrant, it wasn't quite clear whether they presented the evidence to the magistrate who issued it in an appropriate fashion. So this one, I think, is going to have to sort of open up in a very different way, and the administration cannot say to it what it said with respect to the IRS situation. It was just outrageous what we did, and we knew it when we did it. That's not a really powerful political defense. So, I mean, I have no idea. You know, I'm a law professor. I don't know anything about the facts as to who leaked the information from the May 7, 2012 AP story about a foiled plot, a terrorist plot in Yemen. It's obviously a very important issue, and the administration clearly has right to be concerned about the way in which these leaks have developed on national security issues. So it's not the ends that are going to be at issue. It's just going to be the means and the long delay in the discovery of the way in which this thing comes out. So I think you put these two things together, it's a real mess for the administration. You add in Benghazi, where in effect, you know, the president has and mounted, I thought, a relatively effective defense on this thing yesterday. But the synergies, in effect, make each of them seem worse than it would if it were standing alone.
And so final question on that very point, do you think of these three stories and whatever else may accompany them in the days to come, are these bumps, you know, however large in the road, or is this the beginning of what we've talked about on this podcast before, the decay in presidential power that you often see playing out in second terms?
Well, clearly on this particular issue, the president is on the defensive, and to the extent that he has to sort of, you know, bail out water from the SS White House, he's not going to have a lot of free time in order to push other kinds of agenda, for example, on the gun control issue. It may even derail, which I think would be a mistake, some of the stuff that's trying to take place on a bipartisan basis, more or less, with respect to immigration. I think the other sort of looming disaster that the administration is going to have to face is something I wrote about in my Defining Ideas column this week, and that's the question of whether or not they will ever be able to get Obamacare untracked. The amount of administrative effort that it's going to take to get these regulations and rules in place in time for an October 1st launch is at this point stupendous. I don't believe that it can be done. I think most people who know something about the business don't believe that it could be done, but it's quite clear if the administration is now trying to divert itself from to extricate itself from all the problems that it now faces with respect to these sort of looming public scandals, how is it going to have time to get the peace of mind needed to organize implementation of this program in Dodd-Frank? I just don't see how the thing is going to happen, because we know that even if they control this stuff a little bit, which they cannot completely eliminate because the Republicans control the House, there is likely to be something else that will come up with great rapidity. Indeed, my own sense is if there's some other dirty linen in the closet, what will happen is any group that now wants to attack the president will feel that it's a lot easier for them to do so because their credibility will be greater now that these other three issues have broken in very rapid succession one to another. So I think that this is not going to be a nuclear winter for the White House. But, you know, looking at it as an outsider, I would not want to be their lawyer trying to figure out how I organized a credible defense to a multi-front war.
Richard Epstein, thank you as always. And a reminder to our listeners, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by going to hoover.org and clicking on Defining Ideas. And you can follow Richard on Twitter @RichardAEpstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.